This week is Parshat Shlach, and I'm not going to do what I normally do, which is to do what we don't normally do. All right? You can follow that. Today we're going to do what we normally do, which is to talk about the whole story of the quote-unquote scouts. They are scouts, they're quote-unquote meraglim, but they're never called spies really anywhere in Tanakh. The closest we get to it, and this is an independent study, is at the beginning of Sefer Devarim, and I'll just give a little to whet your appetite about this, and maybe we'll do it next year or in another context. At the beginning of Sefer Devarim, there is a short version of this story that's told, and it is extremely different. In the beginning of Sefer Devarim, Moshe tells the people that you approached me and you said, let's send some men, v'yach perulanu et ha'aretz, which means spy out the land, but not diraglu, which is a word we do use in Tanakh, so they don't use that word. Yachbulano ta'aretz, yashivu otanu davar, and they'll tell us what the land is like. And I said, okay, that's a good idea, and I sent people. And then what happens is, Moshe says they came back, and they gave a good report, and you guys all got scared, and you guys refused to go, and yat-ta-da-ta-da, and God got angry, etc. In other words, the way that it's told in Dvarim has three critical differences. Critical difference one is whose idea it is. It comes from the people. And critical difference two is that Moshe sort of takes some fall for it because he says, well, I thought it was a good idea, which if you think about it in retrospect, it wasn't such a good idea. And the third thing, which of course is critical, is that there's no distinction between the 10 guys, the 2 guys, the 1 guy. They're all of them good guys and they all give a good report. And it's the people who freak out and won't go. However, in the core story that we have in Bamidbar, it's of course very different than that. It starts from God saying, Shlach Lecha Anashim. It's a divine mandate. Second thing is that Moshe appoints people who are evidently quite macherly in their tribes and sends each one of a representative from each tribe, except for Levi, interestingly. And we'll talk about why briefly. And they are not at all told to spy out the land. They're told v'yaturu et ha'aretz, which means to scout out the land. They're not going underground. They're not going in any subterfuge or anything like that. They're walking around. They're walking from one end to the other. They're taking 40 days. They're bringing back souvenirs. You know, my parents went to Eretz Yisrael. All I got was a big cluster of grapes. What? Oh, great. Excellent. So it's a very, very different tale. We're going to deal with the story in Bamidbar. It's important to keep that in mind. And a lot of that really connects to a larger issue, which is how we view Sefer Devarim. And narratives that are presented differently in Devarim, mitzvot that are presented differently in Sefer Devarim. And that's something we've talked about in a different context in years past. But let's take a look at the story itself. At the beginning of Perek Yod Dalet, so just to brief you, Moshe sends the people, and basically, his request is to bring back a report about the land. He doesn't really ask very much about the people. He asks about the land. And they come back, and they start out with the proper response. Now, the big goof seems to be that they came back and they addressed him publicly instead of what you would normally expect, which is come in and have a private meeting with just the group and Moshe, maybe Aharon and Elazar, etc., and report what's happening. Instead, it was a big public thing, so everybody's listening. And they said, okay, here's the fruit of the land, and it's a good land, etc., but we saw a bunch of nations that are there, including Amalek. And I say the word Amalek, it's like pressing a Pavlovian button. It was like, Amalek, a freak out. And so Kalev, and we talked about this a couple years ago, Kalev steps in and says, no, we can get there. Now, by the way, nobody at the point says we can't get there, but Kalev says, no, we can do it. We can do it. And so the other guys, we don't know how many of them are, we end up finding out it's 10, respond by then exaggerating their response. So we saw giants and mythical giants and Nephilim and, you know, and at that point, this is what happens. So how did the people react? So everybody starts crying and they're weeping. And when they say, they complain to Moshe and Aaron. Now, who complains? All Bnei Israel. This is not new. We saw this throughout Parshat Bashalach. It's the only place in till now that we saw it. We saw it throughout Parshat Bashalach 3 different times. Thirst, hunger, thirst. And we're going to see it again in Bamidbar with the snakes, you know, the thing that leads to the snakes, etc., they're complaining about the man. We've seen complaints before. All right, so this should not be all that new, and it should not be so much more exacerbated than the rest. And this is something we heard in Mishalach also. We should have died in Mitzrayim. We should have died in the desert. What's the point of coming here? Why does God bring us to this land just to get killed by the sword? In other words, he's bringing us in for slaughter. Our women, our children are all going to be destroyed. Better if we would go back to Mitzrayim. Now, up until now, going back to Mitzrayim was always presented as some sort of a veiled wish, but nothing more than that. Never a plan. There was never a, okay, you know what, Egypt's that way, let's turn around. There was never, hey, the last train for Egypt is leaving in 5 minutes, let's go. There was never that. There was just like, oh, it would have been nice if we were in Egypt. Remember in last week's Parsha, right? Remember all of the free food in Egypt. Yeah, but it's all sort of nostalgic. Now let's get real. Egypt is nowhere good to be. It's like people today, you know, saying, ooh, I wish I was in Europe in the 19th century. Are you kidding? What kind of person with any sense of history would ever want to go back to Europe ever? Certainly not 19th century, early 20th century. What a disaster. Anyhow. But here's the kicker. Now it becomes a plan. Let's appoint a new head. Those were rebellion against Moshe. That we'll get again next week, Parsha Korach. But let's appoint a new head and we'll go back to Mitzrayim. Now it's a plan. Okay. And then the reaction is Kalev and Yehoshua tear their clothes and they say it's a good land and we can get there. And then everything plays out. God comes down and God delivers the decree, etc. Now, when did this all happen? So we know that it's in the second year. We know that it is a year plus after leaving Egypt. So we left Egypt, Pesach. We got to Har Sinai in the third month. We spent almost a year at Har Sinai, which means it's now the end of the second month of the second year. Been out of Egypt for 13 months, and we take off from Har Sinai. And then all that stuff happens in Bahalotcha. The complaining and the Kegrot HaTava, and we get to Chatzirot, and then Miriam with Lashon Hara, and that all happens then. So it's somewhere in the summer of the second year. We're only told one other thing, which is that when Moshe sends the scouts, they hide the Hayamin, you may be Kurean Avim. This is the very beginning of the great growth. Now, just as a parenthesis, but an important one for this story, they pick grapes and they bring the grapes back. First of all, how do they carry the grapes back? So we've all seen the car, right? We've all seen the logo on the car. How do they bring the grapes back? Right, they don't bring the grapes back in a bag with a little twisty top, you know, pavilions, right? How do they grape back how? On their shoulders. Why do they bring the grapes back on their shoulders? When's the last time you carried grapes on your shoulders? So we have Midrashim that the grapes are huge, and which, of course, is not going to be very inviting. See monster mutant Chernobyl grapes or something. Three Mile Island grapes. That's not going to be very inviting. So a friend of mine suggested, and I think he's got a good point, is that, and Howard Labota, he's an enophile and an amateur vintner, actually a professional vintner, and he pointed out that, you know, if you're going to carry grapes through the desert, what's going to happen to them? They will be sun-made, right? So he said, what did they probably take with them? They probably took the whole vine with some dirt. Right, so it would continue being nurtured. So, of course, they have to put it on. You can't carry that in your pocket. Carry them things. Anyhow, so they bring back these grapes. Right? When did they pick the grapes? The beginning or the end? And do you think that they... Because the grapes are from close to where their entry point. Nachal Eshkol. So, do you think they picked the grapes on the way into the land or on the way out of the land? Yeah. Makes sense. On the way out. What are you going to pick up grapes and carry them for 40 days while you're scouting the land and come back? Doesn't make any sense. So they probably picked them on the way out, even though the text doesn't say it in that way, in that order, but that's not our concern. So the one thing we're told is, Hayamim Yumevi Kurean Avim, which means now 40 days later, the grapes are ready to pick, and on the way out, they pick the grapes and they bring them in. Okay, we got that all put together. It makes sense. But we don't have any other date for these events. We don't know what it is. Chazal come and tell us something fascinating. And this is the full development of it. The Mishnah that this Gemara has a comment on is the famous Mishnah that says five terrible things happened to our ancestors on the 17th of Tammuz, and five terrible things happened to them on Tisha B'Av. And on Tisha B'Av, what are the five terrible things? So it's important to remember, Chazal, and this informs totally what we're doing here, Chazal have a hashkafa, have a perspective on history, which is that all major historic events in Jewish history throughout are all anchored in the events of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Everything is anchored in the events of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Chazal find Midrashim that connect Hanukkah to Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Purim is easy with Amalek. And so therefore they say that Tisha B'Av is anchored in Yitzhak Mitzrayim. What was the first thing that happened on Tisha B'Av in history? This night, when they cried, right? And we'll see the Gemara on it. However, there's nothing in the text to suggest that it's Tisha B'Av, so they must be pushed by something else to connect to Tisha B'Av. Let's see what it is. But Tisha B'Av, source 2, I apologize for there wasn't room for translation, Nigzar lo'tenu shlo yikatsu la'aretz. Right? So this is now commenting on the Mishnah that the first decree about Tisha B'Av was the first terrible thing that happened was that our ancestors were told, you will not enter the land, you're going to die out in the desert 40 years, actually 38 years, and your kids will enter the land. Menalan. And they go through the chronology of events from constructing the Mishkan and all the way through dating everything until finally we get to how long it was from the day, the 25th Iyar, when they left Har Sinai, how long they traveled, then how long they were in with the Mitavim, with Asaf Suf, with the 30 days of eating, and they end up having sent the 10, 12 guys out on the 29th of Sivan. Now, the Gemara goes through hoops here to try to make this work. And it even goes through such hoops as to say, well, if they went on the 29th of Sivan, then 40 days later is going to be the 9th of Av, which means if they came back the 9th of Av, then that night people cried. That night was the 10th of Av. So how does it work? Oh, that year of Tammuz was a full month. And therefore it's 2 days Rosh Chodesh, etc. And then they apply it to the Pasuk, Kara alai Moed Lishbor Bachurai, the Pasuk in Echa. God has declared a Moed in order to kill my children. A simple read of a Moed is an appointed time when the enemy is going to come. The drasha here is a Moed, meaning God made that a full month so that it would work out that they would come back on the 8th of Av and that night would be the 9th of Av. That night would be the 9th of Av. Parenthetically, that Pasuk is the source given for why we don't say Tachanun on Tisha B'Av, because it's a Moed. Yeah. Okay, so you take a look at the bottom of the selection. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ota Laila Leil Tisha B'Av Haya. The night that they came back was, meaning they came back on the 8th, and that evening they gave the report, and that night everybody cried, that was Tisha B'Av night. Right? Haya Amar Lama Kodesh Baruch Hu, Atem Bechitem Bechia Shel Chinam, V'ani Koveya Lechem Bechia L'Dorot. The famous line that God said, you cried for naught, I'm going to make this a night of crying forever. And that becomes the night of crying in Jewish history, Tisha B'Av, all because of the way they cry. Now, why? Like, what's the connection between what Tisha B'Av is all about and the event of the Meraglim, as we call them, and the crying? Like, how do the two connect at all? I mean, it's one thing if the text said, and they cried on Tisha B'Av, that, okay, it's right there in your face. You can't do much about it. But here we're going through hoops to make it work out that it is Tisha B'Av. Why? We must be motivated by some other sort of connection. So let's actually take a look at what happens. Look at the story. In the description of their journey, source 3 tells us that they went up and they scouted the land. Went up from where? Where were we hanging out during the year and 3 months, we'll call it, a year and 4 months since we left Egypt? Where were we hanging out all that time? We're hanging out in front of Har Sinai and then traveling towards Eretz Yisrael. I do not know where Har Sinai is. I know one thing, it's not Santa Catarina, but I don't know where Har Sinai is. I know it's somewhere in the Sinai Peninsula, in spite of the people who think it's in the Arabian Peninsula. It's the Sinai Peninsula somewhere. It means it's south of Israel. So if you're going to go from there and finally get the green light to go to Israel, where are you going to go? You're going to go north. Turn the page and take a look. Right. Now again, we don't know where Sinai is, but you see where Kadesh Barnea is. You can even see it in the fuzziness there. Kadesh Barnea. And Kadesh Barnea is the staging point from where they left. All right, so you go from Kadesh Barnea, roughly Kadesh Barnea, and you go north. What's the first city you're going to encounter? I don't know if you can see it on there. It's an ancient city. It's Arad. You see Arad? Okay? You're going to go up to Arad. That's going through the Negev. And from the Negev, you're going to go up into the hill country, Drom Har Hebron, to Hebron. Then you're going to pass this little, tiny little place called Yavuz that will later become Yerushalayim. Then you're going to go to Beit El. And then you're going to go to Shechem. And then you're ultimately going to get down to the valley, and you're going to cross over, and you're going to go to Rehov Levo Hamat, which is in Syria. That's where they went. So take a look at the text. Vayalu Vayatu Atarat, source 3. Imbartzina Rehov Levo Hamat. Vayalu Vanega Vayavar Hebron. So they went up. Okay, we're talking about Hebron. Okay. Now, what happens as a result of our reaction to the report? Their report is these enemies are there, they're strong, they're big, and finally, mythic creatures, giants are going to step on us. We're like grasshoppers. What's our reaction? We cry, we whimper, not going to work. The decree is made. What's the decree? The decree is you have to let a whole generation die out in the desert, you're going to wander around. Now, what would be the most reasonable approach to take if you say, okay, you got to wait 40 years, really 38 years, a total of 40 since you left, and then enter the land? What would be the most reasonable arrangement to make for travel? What would you do? You're in the desert, and you're about to enter the land. You're told you can't enter the land yet. You got to enter in the next generation. Stay in the desert. Let a generation die out, and your kids will come in. You can't. What would you do?
Stay put.
Set up a little 40-year settlement, and get comfortable, and settle in, and find whatever agriculture you can find nearby, and make sure you're near some watering holes, and go from there. Instead, they wander. They wander. They keep moving around. They don't move around a lot, because for a long time they're in Kadesh Barnea, but they move, and then they ultimately move, and take a look at the map on the back, and you see the route that they take. They go down as far as Eilat, probably didn't have a chance to go scuba diving, and then they go up the east bank, and they have to make a large circle. Why do they have to make a large circle? So it's a strange thing. Look at source 4. In Parshat Devarim, Moshe recounts. Remember, Sefer Devarim is all told at the very end point, the staging point for crossing into Israel. Moshe's dying, and he's saying goodbye, and this is his farewell speech. And in that farewell speech, he says, you know how we got here, guys? We had to travel all around. Remember, he retells the story of this event. And then he says, what did God say to us as we were coming? He said, Al Tatzar Moav. You can't go to war against Moav. Moav is southwest Jordan. Right in our path. You can't go to war against Moab. If Moab won't let you pass through, you got to go around. Big circle. Well, you know what? You and I are out hiking. I don't mind doing an extra mile. A million people, a lot of kids and old people, that's a big problem. Got to make a big circle. And we're not done. I know, right? In source 5, I don't know anything anymore. I tell you, Hayom Ekvul Moab. All right? I tell you, Mul B'nei Amon. From Moab, you go to Amon. Amon is central Jordan. All right? You can't mess with them. You can't provoke them. Notice why? Just like with Moab, you notice it in source 4. In source 5, God says, you cannot take Ammon's property because it belongs to whom? Not Ammon. It belongs to Bnei Lot. So I know that Ammon and Moab are both children of Lot. I know the whole story with the cave and the bottle of wine in West Virginia. I know that. But why is the Torah emphasizing, and Moshe's repeating what God said, you cannot go through their land because it belongs to Bnei Lot? What's that about? So turn the page and you'll see an interesting piece that takes us all the way back to Bereshit. In source 6, which is from Sefer Dvarim, from Parshat Ekev, right before Vayayim Shemua Tishma, we hear the following about coming to the land. And Parshat Ekev is the beginning and the end of it are about Eretz Yisrael. Ki Aretz Asher Atav Hashem L'Rishta Aloche Eretz Yitzrayim Hi Asher Yitzatem Misham Asher Tizrat Zarachak Vishkita V'Raglachak Gan Ayarak. Eretz Yisrael is not like Egypt. Egypt is all irrigated. You got the Nile and you want some to grow something, just dig a channel off the Nile and you can grow something. The land you're coming to inherit is a land of hills and valleys. It doesn't have any rivers in it. You're going to get rainwater. So what? I mean, what's the difference if I'm getting rainwater or river water? So the answer is the next pasuk. Eretz asher Adonai Elohecha doresh otah. It's a land that God himself seeks out. What does that mean? River water is always there. You know how long it takes to have an impact from what happens in, what is it, Lake Victoria in Kenya, wherever it is, that's the headwaters of the Nile, until the Nile really feels an impact of it? It takes years. Rain? It doesn't rain today. There's no water. Maximum, I can save up enough for a couple weeks if I have a good cistern and a good runoff system. But that's it. Huge difference. Tamid enei Adonai Elohecha b'mereshit ha'shana b'yarachai shana. God is always looking at the land. Now, it sounds like some sort of perverted blessing, or shall we say perverted curse. God's always looking at the land, so you won't always have water. So you're always going to be stuck. You're always going to be needy. And you're always going to be on the brink of extinction. But it's a fundamentally different kind of relationship. So before looking at the last source and putting it all together, I'll tell you something I heard many, many years ago, and I don't remember whose name it is, so if anybody here knows who it is, let me know. In the beginning of Bereshit, three get cursed. The serpent, whatever that is, woman, capital W, man, capital M, types. The curse of the serpent is you eat dirt, which if you think about it, isn't such a curse, because dirt is free. Matter of fact, it's dirt cheap. And it's everywhere. You have no problem getting it. Your food bill just went down to zero. What's the big whoop? So I heard a great explanation. Again, it's an archaic parable that doesn't really work for us, but I think we can use our imagination. He's a king. And the king, this may be the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, I'm not sure. The king has two sons. And one of them is a diligent, thrifty, thoughtful, good administrator, really fit to take over the throne. And the other one is not. Typical silver spoon. So the king, at one point, the boys reach the age of 21 or whatever it is, at one point, he sets them up. So he sets up the lout with a kingdom far away at the very edge of the empire and gives him $1 gazillion in a trust fund, which feeds him all the time, and enough food, enough guards, enough everything, so he's set for life. And the son that he loves and who he trusts, he sets up in a very nearby duchy with enough of an allowance for a week. And every week his son comes to him and says, I need more money to pay the guards, to pay the food, et cetera. He gives him money. Finally, after about 2 months, the son comes and says, I don't get it. My brother, who you and I both agree is not going to win a Nobel Prize for anything, and he got failing marks even on failing in school, you gave him everything. And me, who we both agree is more fit to take over, and you've already named me as your crown prince, you keep me on a short leash. I don't get it. He said, that's exactly the reason. Your brother, between you, me, and your mother, if I never see him again, it won't be soon enough. But you, I love you. I miss you. So if at the very least you come to me once a week and ask me for money, at least I get to see you. So God says to the snake, go to hell. I don't want you. Here's dirt, take it and leave. But man, I love you. So I'm going to give you food that you're going to have to work for, and you have to pray for rain, and you have to look to me. Now you think about the difference between being fed by rainwater or being fed by river water. When you're fed by river water, where do you look for your life? You look down. You look for rainwater, where do you look for your life? You look up. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in blessing Eretz Yisrael, says that's the blessing of Eretz Yisrael. It's a land where you're connected to God all the time. You're always in need. You're always in relationship. Because God loves you. God wants you to be close. Okay, so now take a look at what happens. Before that, I just want to tell you one story. It's a story about a city. It's actually, sorry Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities. But tell me if you could tell me which city this is. And this is a far, far better thing. A couple of people come into the city for refuge. They come actually to check out what's going on in the city and to find if there are any righteous people in the city. They are given hospitality by somebody with a very shady sexual issue. And they escape. The city is destroyed miraculously by things falling down. And the only ones to escape during the destruction are the ones who gave him hospitality and their kin. What city is that?
Jericho.
Jericho. What other city is that? I told you, the tale of two cities.
Stone.
It's exactly Stone. So you think about it. When you're reading Sefer Yoshua, the first city we're supposed to conquer is Jericho. I get why Jericho is the first city to conquer, because it's the point of ingress. But why aren't we supposed to just take it over and settle it and use it as our next camp? Why are we supposed to destroy it, utterly destroy it, and never touch it? Because Jericho is not a battle of conquest. Jericho is, if you will, a battle of self-conquest. Think about it. Lot. Lot represents a stain of perspective on religiosity, as we're going to read in a moment. We have to demonstrate that we have the moral high ground over Lot. Let's see about Lot, and then we'll get to the moral high ground. Look at the last source. Avram and Lot's shepherds have a fight. Famous. And whatever the fight's about, Machloket Rishonim, are they fighting over land, or are they fighting over theft, or are they fighting over the fact that they're fighting? Unclear. But they're fighting. Avram says to Lot, Al nati miriva b'ni uvenecha, there shouldn't be a fight between me and you, between our shepherds. We're kin. And what has he said? Say to him, separate. What does that mean? Right, I'll go one way, you go the other way. Except that doesn't mean that, because in Tanakh, yamin and small are actually real directions. Because in Tanakh, all directions assume you're facing east. East is Kedem, in front of you. Because ancient navigators would always orient themselves, hence the Orient, by facing the rising sun. So Yamin is south, and Smol is north. And Smol is used as north elsewhere in the Avram story, when he's chasing the kings. Smol Adameset. So what does Yamin Vasmil Smol Vayamin mean? If you go north, I'll go south. If you go south, I'll go north. Where is Avraham and Lot at the time? They're in Beit El, which means where's north? Shechem. We're south, Hebron. All in the mountains. What does Lot do? By Solot Etenav, he looks down, but he looks east. And what does he see? Take a look very carefully what he sees. By the way, where did Avram and Lot just come back from with it so rich? How come Avram and Lot are so rich that they're having fights within the shepherds? Because they came back from where? From Egypt, where they became enriched. All right, so take a look. Vayisa Lot etenav, in the middle of the paragraph. Vayar kol kikar yaden kucholam ashkeah. The whole area is just lush. Why? This is before the big cataclysm that made the Dead Sea. Kingan Adonai ke'eretz Mitzrayim bo'chatzor. It's like the Garden of God, like the land of Egypt. Now this is what Lot's seeing. What's Lot seeing? Lot's seeing a little piece of Mitzrayim in Israel. I can't go back to Mitzrayim. We were thrown out of the country. Our visas were stamped persona non grata. But I can find a little bit of Mitzrayim here. So he goes to Sodom. And by the way, what does the text next say? The people in Sodom are terrible people. Okay, but Lot wants to go there anyways because he wants Mitzrayim. Lot likes Mitzrayim. What does Lot like about Mitzrayim? What Mitzrayim is? What's Mitzrayim? It's all there for you. You don't need God. It's right there for you. Now go back to our story. What did the people say when they cried that night? Let's go back to Mitzrayim. We don't want to be in a situation where we have to turn to God. Please help us in this war. Please save us from these enemies. We want to be in a place where everything's fine, even if it means being slaves. Even if it means going back to Egypt, even if it means erasing the most important line in our history, which is, Anochi Adonai Elohecha asher hotzeitecha me'eretz Mitzrayim. Erase all of that. Erase Mamad Har Sinai. Just go back and have it easy. So what's the result of that? You have demonstrated that you're no better than Lot. If you know better than Lot, then the first thing is you have no right to conquer Lot's land. And therefore, when you wander, you're going to have to wander around. Second thing is that you have now made exile a permanent feature in the landscape of the Jewish people. Because you've demonstrated that the fear of actually stepping in and taking it is something that's overwhelmed you. And therefore, instead of erasing the steps that Yaakov took when he went down to Egypt by coming back the same way, you turn it into a full circle and you made it part of the permanent landscape. And therefore, what happens tonight? Tonight becomes a night of permanent exile. Tonight is the night in which you made exile a permanent part of Jewish life. By your crime, by your fear, by your inability to embrace the greatness that was thrust on you and the opportunity. And so Chazal do all of these hoops in order to make... Does it bother me if it actually was Tisha B'Av? No, it doesn't bother me. Chazal are trying to give an idea. Trying to say, this is where Tisha B'Av starts. Exile starts when you're afraid to embrace the challenge. And when you take Lot. So therefore, you're going to have to wander around, and you're going to have to wander all the way around B'nai Lot because you don't have a right to take their land. And what's the first step you got to do when you come into Israel? You've got to demonstrate that you do have the moral high ground over Lot. You've got to reenact the destruction of stone. And therefore, the first city you got to conquer is Jericho, which goes down like stone, in order to say, we've moved beyond that. And Kol's mind that you could stay beyond that, you could stay in the land. And then chart out how exile in its cycles plays out, and you'll see every time it's always out of an unwillingness to embrace the great opportunities.